On the program today, we will look at health disparities. But first, a new case of Ebola virus has been identified in the city of Beni in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the country's National Institute for Biomedical Research said on Monday. Testing showed the case was genetically linked to the 2018-2020 outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, which killed nearly 2,300 people, said a statement from Placide Mbala, chief of the Pathogen Genomics Laboratory at INRB. Congo's most recent outbreak was in a different part of the country and was declared over in July after 5 deaths. Investigations are ongoing to determine the source. Experts say Ebola can sometimes linger in the eyes, central nervous system, and bodily fluids of survivors and flare up years later. We turn now to health disparities in cancer care. According to the World Health Organization, there are wide disparities in the health status of different social groups in all countries, whether low, middle, or high income. The lower an individual's socioeconomic position, the higher the risk of poor health. Health disparities are avoidable differences in the burden of disease, injury, violence, or opportunities for optimal health that socially disadvantaged populations face. WHO says 87% of premature death due to non-communicable diseases occur in low- and middle-income countries. According to the U.S. National Cancer Institute, people with more education are less likely to die prematurely before the age of 65 from colorectal cancer than those with less education, regardless of race or ethnicity. And African Americans have higher death rates than all other racial and ethnic groups for many cancer types. For more on the subject, I spoke with Dr. Robert Wynn, director of VCU Massey Cancer Center, who is spearheading interdisciplinary approaches to cancer disparities research, among other things.
Dr. Robert Wynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The COVID-19 pandemic has revealed one fact that is known for years, which is health disparities among communities, especially when it comes to minorities and African-American communities. Access to healthcare has been a challenge for many people. And the gap, it seems, has been even wider during the COVID-19 pandemic. First of all, how do health disparities affect minority communities? And what are some of the main causes?
Yeah, so as we think about health disparities, and let me get it right, it's a not just a difference in outcomes, but it's a difference in outcomes as a result of things like structure. And so, for example, I'll give you a quick example. Prostate cancer in the United States, certainly everybody knows that there's a substantial difference between the outcome of Black men and white men, except in the VA system. It turns out that when given the same access, the same quality of doctors, the same medicines, the same everything, you don't see that difference between Black and white men in the outcomes of prostate cancer. This is what I talk about disparities. So I'm very specific when we talk about disparities. That is those differences that can be accounted for, not just by biology, but by our structures. And so there's many examples. COVID was an example of, particularly in the beginning of COVID, when we had a difference in Black-white deaths, Black-white uptake in the vaccine. But you know what the funny part is? COVID actually showed us one thing, that when you want to close a health disparities gap, you can. By the middle or almost towards the middle of the COVID, when the vaccines are given, we could see that through efforts that were on the ground in communities, that we closed the Black-white gap in the context of vaccine uptake. So I'm an optimist that understands that when we want to address these issues of health disparities, we can.
That's very interesting. So for those who do not really know, could you clarify when you talked about the VA system?
The VA system is the system of veteran affairs. It's where all of our men and women who served in the armed forces, they have a system built in the United States where they can actually receive their care. The most wonderful part is in that Veterans Administration system, they're getting the same access to the same medicines, doctors, all at the same way, at the same time. And what's wonderful about our VA system is that when you think about breast cancer disparities, when you think about prostate cancer disparities between Blacks and whites, those are almost completely annihilated to zero when you have a health system like the Veteran Affairs system that just sees the patients and not, you know, all the other things that go with it.
You mentioned the VA system seeing the patients as the person as opposed to all the other things. What are all the other things?
We've taken a shorthand of that now. We call it the reason why there is disparities is, quote, social determinants of health. That means that there are some populations, some communities that don't have the same type of access to transportation or the access to good foods or the access to even healthcare. Well, you know what? It's beyond the hashtag social determinants of health. There are real structures. There's historical structures, things like redlining that were started in the 1930s and popularized and then expanded throughout the entire country. But more importantly than just the federal and sanctioned segregation of the races that contributed, obviously, to disease, there's this more interesting thing that happened in the 50s and 60s, the urban renewal programs that actually literally drove, in some cases, we call it white roads through black bedrooms, devastating many of these communities. And by the way, exposing many of these communities to the diesel fumes that other people weren't. We know that ultimately, by those acts, we also built, industries and businesses in those undesirable areas, exactly predisposing and exposing communities to more hazardous air than others. So when we talk about health disparities and the structures that are involved, let's quit talking about the fact that just because I'm an African-American, I just happen to be more predisposed to lung cancer or more predisposed to a different kind of cancer without taking into account the structures that contributed that. And by the way, these are some of the same structures that not only are impacting, you know, communities of color, they're also impacting rural areas as well. So let's get it straight that it's not just folks of color. There are rural areas that actually have also suffered from structural issues that are contributing to their disease.
Let's narrow down to cancer. When we talk about disparities, what does it look like for the Black community in particular? What are some critical gaps?
You know what? I wish I could tell you something good here, but here's the news. We know that 1 in 2 men and 1 in 3 women will get cancer in their lifetime. That we know. But as African-American communities, we also know that when it comes to the group dying most from lung cancer, African-American men. The group dying most from breast cancer, African-American women. The sad thing is I can go down almost each and every category and tell you that the African-American community is disproportionately having a negative impact and negative outcomes on their cancer. And by the way, you know, there are other things like, for example, Latino Latinx kids, you know, with leukemias, they get it more often and they actually have poorer outcomes. So we can see disparities throughout the entire communities, but certainly in the African-American community, there's almost very few cancers that you can point to that we're not number one. And that is a number one that's not good.
What can be done to improve health disparities? I mean, it's a big question because there is so much that needs to be done. But if you were to point to 2-3 steps that can move the needle, what would you say?
I love the optimism in that question because it moves us from just framing the problems to what we can do. Step number one is recognizing that there are absolutely structures in the way of getting people access to care. So, you know, things like the expanded healthcare that we've actually had is a good thing in the context of giving people access to care. Number two, we're going to actually have to think that what we did with COVID, we're going to have to repeat for cancer. What do I mean? When we had the disparity of the access to the vaccine or the disparities in African-Americans versus whites getting the vaccine, that gap was closed, not because all of a sudden it just happened, but because there were real boots on the ground engaging communities and getting them to understand and bringing the science closer to our communities of getting them to understand the benefits of science to them. And in fact, that wasn't just a drop in and drop out. That was a consistent effort of having boots on the ground, working not for and not, you know, I'm working on behalf of the community, working with the community to come up with the solutions. That's two. And the last one is an easy one. We are going to actually have the will. It's, you know, listen, we have had disparities experts for 40 years who've actually told us how to solve this problem. Most of it, it's not an issue that we don't know what to do or don't even know how to do it. It's like a diet. We understand that losing weight is good for everybody. We even have 10,000 ways of doing it. But if you commit the one, you would lose weight. The same thing is true in health disparities. If we commit to the effort around reducing the disparities with resources from both state, federal government, and from philanthropic sources. If we commit to this work of committing to our communities and working with them, I think we can actually see and move the needle in the context of reducing the burden of cancer in the United States, for sure.
Community mistrust has been a challenge in addressing healthcare disparities. When people do not trust a system, how do you get them to go and get the information they need or get the resources, the treatment? How do you get them to participate in that system when they do not trust it? What is your reaction on the minority's mistrust of health systems?
Yeah, you're talking a reality. Now, let me say that their mistrust has been validated on some actual objective distrust because of some actual events, historic and otherwise. Now, we go back and always talk about Tuskegee, but let's not forget that there's been many more incidents than Tuskegee, and even current acts of today where people go into places and feel that they've been discriminated against. So I want to say that this is not a figment of anyone's imagination. The mistrust is actually warranted. What do we do about it? Now, the reality is you can't just go and get mistrust out of people's minds because it's a belief, right? You can't move a belief by just sort of saying, trust me. You have to actually earn the trust through institutional trustworthiness. I think we're at a new era of recognizing that it's not enough to build trust. What we have to do is look and reflect on our institutional trustworthiness. So what does that mean? That means the ability to show that you're trustworthy. That means that we're going to have to work on a new day where we're like not just talking about access, but maybe even showing different institutions and who actually has access and who doesn't. How else do you build it? Is that you have to not just be there for the crisis, but the crazy part is, I think that this is a lesson for our institutions and our communities. As my community member once put it, why weren't you here before the crisis? I actually think as we move through reducing mistrust, we're going to need to be there not just today, but tomorrow and then tomorrow. We're going to need a sustainable effort working with our partners within a community. And by the way, making sure that we're training that young generation to bring them into science. I don't think mistrust is going to go away just by sort of saying, hey, we have a great miracle drug. If that were true, the vaccine would have had 100% uptake in the beginning. But we did not even trust the fact that we had this miracle drug because we distrusted the communicators, which were frequently doctors and scientists, because again, many of us have done these miracles without actually involving the community. And as my grandmother used to say, people don't care how much you know until they know that you care. I think if we're going to reduce mistrust, it's going to be showing the communities how much we care in a consistent and sustainable fashion.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. We'll have more on my discussion with Dr. Robert Wynn after the break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. On the program today, we are discussing health disparities with Dr. Robert Wynn, director at VCU Massey Cancer Center, and the first African-American director of a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center. Here is more of my conversation with Dr. Wynn.
One issue that I wanted you to talk about is health literacy. Many experts say that one of the major impediments to health equity is the fact that some communities are not educated about their health. To what extent is this a reality among minorities, communities, and what can be done?
I hear this quite frequently about our communities being scientifically illiterate, but I heard from a community member back when I was in Chicago, this older woman sort of said, well, we illiterate too. And what she meant by that is that your community may be illiterate in scientific illiteracy, but we're illiterate of those communities. And so what I think, it's a new reframing of the knowledge that has to be gained on both sides. It is not going to be enough for, quote, just the community to be more literate about the science if the scientists and the health systems are illiterate to the struggles, the structures within our communities. And so I think that there's literacy on both sides and work on both sides to be done so that we can bridge that gap and really actually reduce health disparity.
What a good point you made, because usually when we talk about health literacy, it's a one-way street, right? It's those communities that do not know, they're not informed. But it's so important what you just say about the two-way street.
That's right. There's health literacy and there's community literacy, and they both matter. And one without the other might give you some benefit, but if we're really looking for the real benefit of reducing disparities, we have to have not only health literacy, but community literacy, meaning from the health systems, from the hospitals, the academic institutions that are all well-meaning, but are very illiterate about those communities and about the streets in which they say they want to make impact. That is actually one of the biggest lessons learned I hope we all take away from what just happened or during this period of COVID.
You've launched a fact and faith conversation series during the COVID pandemic to create what you perceived as a needed dialogue. So tell us more about the initiative and the sort of impact you have witnessed.
That's probably the best thing I've been a part of. It started actually in May of 2020. If you can go back that far, remember when nobody knew anything about COVID other than it was just, you know, wreaking havoc. It sounds more like a joke, but it was a reality. A doctor, a lawyer, and a faith-based leader get together. And that's what happened organically. In fact, there was Pastor F. Todd Gray from the Fifth Street Baptist Church and Rudeen Mercer Haynes got together and said, "Doc, we don't really know what information to give our parishioners. We don't even know if we should go back to church. How can we actually get a group together and give them reliable information?" And I'll underline reliable, trustworthy information. So we decided to do the Facts, Faith, and Friday series. We meet every Friday from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. And in fact, the funny part about that is that I'm going to just take credit for the part that I did with the name. I gave it the Friday part. The Facts and Faith, that your facts are not at war with your faith, came from our faith-based leader, but I did add the Friday. This is a meeting in which we've had people like Tony Fauci, Anthony Fauci come on, Dr. Fauci. We've had Dr. Collins. We've had our state representatives. We've had federal, you know, people from the federal government. We've had people from the CDC and FDA coming to talk directly to these people. And as a result, the crazy thing is you can see that where you have participation of faith-based leaders within the Facts, Faith, and Friday, you had not only an uptake of vaccines, but you can say that their churches have been probably on par, the most safest in this whole two and a half years fiasco that we've been through. They've kept their people safe and they've kept their community safe as a result of getting useful, reliable, and consistent information. So it's been the most wonderful thing I've been able to participate in.
Do you see this as something to continue for perhaps other challenges or other topics?
The wonderful part about this is that we're not stopping. We now are actually thinking about the new crisis of the lack of screening that's happened in cancer. We're tackling, believe it or not, diabetes and hypertension and other things. So the most wonderful thing about this is that this was started as a result of COVID, but we see it won't stop as a result. When COVID ends, we will still continue to have our Facts, Faith Friday meetings because it turns out this connection between the community and academic center of giving trusted and trustworthy data that's reliable, consistent, and accessible is something that they appreciate. And what I appreciate is the immediate feedback that comes from the community. So we will hopefully continue this for the next 25 years.
What lessons have you learned in that process that perhaps other communities can duplicate?
I think there are three quick lessons. The first one is, think like the wisest of men and women, as W.B. Yeats says, but communicate in the language of the people. We usually don't talk. We usually talk at. We don't speak to. We speak over. And so the context of having the humility and the grace to understand that we need to work with and learn from our community is actually central. The other thing I learned is that many of the successes and many of the keys of reducing any health disparity is not in an academic center, it's not in the health system, it's not in a hospital, it's in the community. And when you have the grace and ultimately humility to be able to understand that we will learn more by working with our community and then taking that information and giving it back to the community, that's when we're gonna see some success. And then the last thing is, you know, showing up just for the crisis is not gonna ever win trust. You need to be there before there's a crisis, during the crisis, after the crisis, and then after that. And so being a sustainable, visible presence effort of being flexible and accessible is actually one of the biggest things that I learned over the last couple of years.
Dr. Robert Wynn, what is your final message?
My final message is that we will never do great things with a focus on just or a steady diet of pessimism and nihilism. I understand that there's a lot of reasons why people are frustrated. But the truth of the matter is great things happen when there's optimism and hope. I think that there's reasons to be hopeful. I think, and there's reasons to be somewhat optimistic, realistically speaking. The new medicines, the fact of the matter is in my lifetime, I've had a front row seat and talking to patients who had lung cancer when I was a medical student and understanding that that was the end of the road. There was nothing to offer. I've gone all the way from that to understanding that someone who comes into the clinic now despondent, I can offer them multitudes of miracles involving molecular targeted therapy, immunotherapy. I have now a multiple toolkit of available things that I can use, including even better chemotherapy, that now means that people are not just surviving their cancer, but thriving. When only 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was a death sentence. When I think about hope, the hope isn't rooted in some sort of pie in the sky. It's rooted in what I see every day and the advances that science has really made in people. I just wish more people could understand the ability of now reducing the lung cancer deaths by 50%. I wish they could feel and sense the progress that's been made over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years.
Dr. Robert Wynn, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Robert Wynn, director at VCU Massey Cancer Center. In honor of Dr. Wynn's commitment to diversifying clinical trial research, Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation recently renamed the $100 million five-year initiative to increase diversity in clinical trials to the Robert A. Wynn Diversity in Clinical Trials Award Program. Now to South Sudan, where refugees living in various camps in South Sudan's White Nile state are protesting a decision by aid organizations in camps to cut down food rations. Some refugees say the decision affects their families' welfare as they have nowhere else to find food. Some of the refugees describe the situation in the camp as hard and say they prefer to return to South Sudan and live with dignity. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
South Sudanese refugees in Sudan, most of whom are women, have been protesting at the main entrance of the World Food Program office in Sudan's White Nile state over the past few days, saying it is unfair to cut their food rations at a time when the refugees are in dire need of food. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via phone from Al-Kashaf refugee camp in White Nile state, Julia Ramadan describes the decision as shocking. Ramadan, a mother of seven, says any cuts of food rations will hurt her family. She's appealing with aid organizations to give them the full ratio.
We are surprised with the decision about the new food ration distribution. Since yesterday, they started giving refugees' families half of the monthly quota. If I take the amount of sorghum I received for grinding, it will not last for 10 days.
Ramadan says women continue to face hardships during war, in refugee camps, and in all aspects of life. She said aid groups should consider this before cutting rations.
We as women are the ones bearing the suffering every day. We take care of kids alone. Men normally go to the market or to the place of work and come late. Women are those who endure the sufferings.
Another South Sudanese refugee, Bulus Pajuan, who also lives in Al-Kashaf refugee camp, says the refugees were not informed in advance about the cut in rations. Pajuan, who heads a family of seven, says the refugees are at risk of facing hunger this rainy season. He says at this time of the year, there is no much casual work refugees could find to take care of their families.
We kept on protesting about this decision, but at the end of the day, we are forced to face this reality. We are hungry and we don't have a choice rather than receiving what has been given to us. They put pressure on us and we have surrendered and are now getting half ration.
Pajuan, who fled violence in Upper Nile State in 2014, says he prefers to return to South Sudan rather than suffering in the camp. He says he understands that the political, social, and economic situation in Sudan is becoming difficult and therefore hope to return to his home in Melakal town soon.
At the end of this rainy season, most of us men have decided to go back to South Sudan to assess the situation, find something to do, and provide for our families. Even though we know that there is insecurity there, we don't have any choice only to go back to South Sudan.
The UN humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Eddie Rowe, told this program in late June that about a third of Sudan's population, or 15 million people, face acute food insecurity.
The combined effects of the economic and political crisis, conflict and displacement, climate shocks, including droughts and floods, and a poor harvest in the past agricultural season are among the key drivers of food insecurity in Sudan. To compound the situation, the conflict in Ukraine is further driving up food and fuel prices in Sudan, which is dependent on food imports, with more than half of the country's wheat imports stemming from the Black Sea region.
White Nile State hosts about 300,000 South Sudanese refugees, a majority of whom fled violence in Upper Nile State, according to a UN Refugee Agency report released in July 2022. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Nora Majero is the Kenyan engineer who created Vaxibox, a small mobile solar-powered fridge that safely stores and transports medicines like vaccines for use in field vaccinations and remote clinics. Majero is the first Kenyan and the second woman to win the Royal Academy of Engineering's Africa Prize for Engineering Innovation.
This solar-powered fridge was initially meant to help farmers preserve their produce, but the CEO of Drop Access says the pandemic made them rethink their focus.
So I have a bit of experience working in rural communities trying to provide clean energy solutions. And I started by working with farmers by providing them solar pumping solutions. Then afterwards, they decided to start asking for solar cold storage solution. So my team and I sat down to design an ideal solar refrigerator that is good for storing milk and poultry products. And during that time, before we launched fully into the market, COVID hit. And that's when we decided to pivot our solution to target the healthcare system.
Two units have been assembled, one in Isungu and another in Makueni County.
So after Vaxibox setting in, at least we are unable to immunize on a daily basis. We are no longer scheduling. When a client comes, we don't postpone or go tell him or her to go back daily, back home. So we are doing it on a daily basis. Again, we are sure the range of temperatures we are using are correct, because the fridge tag is there and is monitoring the temperatures are in the right range.
Real-time monitoring is done through a cold chain solutions provider in Nigeria using IoT, or Internet of Things. The fridge uses solar energy and the solar energy production units for the off-grid energy through another company called PEG.
And also it's saving the environment. I mean, the fridge is solar powered and it's just reducing the amount of fossil fuels that will have been used to keep vaccines cold. And in turn, we ensure that we increase the renewable energy technologies that are being used in the healthcare space.
The WHO Director General says more effort needs to be made to reach remote areas. Majero says challenge accepted.
Looking at the future, we want to onboard as many more investors to come in and work with us, so that we build our own production workshop that will allow us to produce more Vaxibox units and serve our growing wait list. But then also we just want to get pre-qualified by WHO and get their certification. And this move will also enable us to sell as many Vaxibox units as we can and literally any place within the continent.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus and other health news, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is Heidi Adams, host of Straight Talk Africa. Join me to explore what is now and what is next for African society, culture, and politics. We'll go behind the headlines to analyze the news and emerging trends shaping Africa today. Straight Talk Africa. Every